Hey, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening again, depending upon where in the world you are. This is Eric Rubenstein. I am Advise Health's Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support, and welcome to another episode of Retro Fraud. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to bring back one of my past interviews and guests, Matt Lawhorn. Matt, if you have been keeping up with watching my podcasts on Advise's YouTube channel, you'll be familiar with the fact that I've interviewed him previously with respect to a pretty good case that he had involving hearing aids. I decided to bring Matt back because we speak very frequently about a lot of different topics in the healthcare space, and we were talking just recently about ambulance fraud. And while he was an investigator at the Mifuku, if you recall, he worked a lot with my former agency, HHS-OIG, out of the Dallas region. We have a lot of people in common, and we started to talk a lot about ambulance fraud cases, and I thought it'd be a great way to bring Matt back and talk a little bit about ambulance fraud and how it really is not so much a retro fraud so much as those schemes don't really ever change all that much. It's just sort of one of those things that perpetuates itself. And just as a refresher, Matt currently is on the dark side. He works as an attorney doing a little bit of everything in the healthcare space, a lot of criminal work and some regulatory compliance work. But if you recall from my first interview with Matt, he really has this 360-degree view. I said to him earlier today, he's three sides of the coin, because he started off as an investigator for what was then known as either the ZPICs or the PSCs, depending upon the time period that we're talking about. And he did that for a little bit, and then left there and was a police officer, and then left there and was a Mifuku detective for a while, and was going to law school. And so, you know, he's had sort of that full range of doing healthcare law enforcement. We'll call it administrative law enforcement by working for the Medicare contractors. Obviously, as an attorney now, you know, he's seeing that full range of the healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse and compliance stuff. So, Matt, I'm super excited to have you back. And obviously, as a retro fraud, I decided that I was going to wear a retro badge from the OIG. I know we were talking about that a little bit. The OIG badges have changed over time, and each agency sort of had their own badge. And then a number of years ago, way before I retired, all the OIGs got together and created a uniform badge. So I thought for retro fraud, I would wear a retro badge, and you can just wear your retro hat of where you went to law school. So as always, thanks for coming back on, and we're going to talk a little bit about ambulance fraud and some of the issues with that. So I know that there was a case that you worked, because you worked a lot with HHS-OIG. And
right.
For those that don't really understand that dynamic, in different states, the Medicaid fraud control units have different relationships with the federal partners that they may or may not work with. And depending upon the state that you're in, depending upon even within the state, the area that you work, that relationship may be better than other relationships. Mm-hmm. And I know you and I have talked pretty extensively about the fact that you worked a lot with the HHS-OIG people. And when you and I first met, it was kind of amazing how many people we actually had in common, and the fact that we hadn't met before at anything along the way, just because I know I had traveled to Dallas for some OIG-related stuff or training where we'd have, you know, sort of that. So, you know, you also had a little bit more of a unique exposure to things, because although you were a state investigator and had state law enforcement authority, you know, you got to work a lot with people at the U.S. Attorney's Office and the HHS-OIG people, so got to understand a little bit more about that. And for those that don't know, there's a little bit of a defining line when it comes to transportation with respect to Medicaid versus Medicare. And similarly with other things in the healthcare, Medicaid, Medicare space, there are things that Medicaid pays for that Medicare doesn't. You know, for example, outside of ambulance transportation under Medicaid, there's a defined benefit for things like vision and dental. But the vision and dental benefits do not inherently exist in traditional Medicare. They may be add-ons for things like Medicare Advantage, where you can get vision or dental or things like that, but they're a defined benefit in Medicaid. And similarly, in transportation, There are some things that Medicaid pays for that Medicare doesn't pay for. So, Matt, why don't I'm going to turn it over to you so you can give us the landscape of what, let's give a quick overview of sort of what the differences are between what Medicaid would pay for in the transportation world versus Medicare. And then let's get right into talking about some of the fraud schemes.
Yeah. So, just like you said, there's a different benefit under Medicaid. Now, I want to just backtrack a little bit, because you did a great job of explaining how MFUKUs and OIGs can typically interact. I think ambulance fraud in Texas was somewhat of not necessarily unique, but the reason I was able to work so many cases at the federal level with HHS OIG is because Texas has a great deal or a large population of dual eligible beneficiaries. And for the listeners out there that might not be familiar with that term, it means the patient is covered under Medicare and Medicaid simultaneously. So what we would see a lot in our complaints or allegations is that, Medicaid might be fleeced, but then when we reach out to HHS OIG, we would also notice that the program was being fleeced by the provider. And in many instances, it was the same patient because the patient was dual eligible, right? Now, going back to your original question, Medicaid too covers ambulance transports, emergency transports, and then they do have a very narrowly defined benefit for the regularly scheduled non-emergent transport. Essentially, the dispositive factor, using my lawyer lingo, right? Dispositive, it just means kind of the most important one is that transportation by other means is contraindicated. They're bed confined and it's not safe to take them in another way, right? So both programs cover that. Medicaid goes a little bit further in this, from the standpoint that wheelchair vans are also covered strictly by Medicaid. So if they're confined to a wheelchair, they can go by a wheelchair van, by a participating provider, a provider that is participating in the Medicaid program for that specific service, they can get paid. And in Texas, because each state operates its own Medicaid program, there can be some variances. In Texas, family members or friends can actually get compensated for transporting their family member to and from covered healthcare services, right? So those two types of transportation are unique to the Texas, unique to the Medicaid program, and are things that we encountered here in Texas. So,
yeah. So the interesting thing is, in every state, those rules are going to be a little different. For example, in New York, there's something called accessoride or accessoride, depending upon, who you're talking to and how they're reading the side of the truck. But that's a Medicaid covered service that is, through the state for transportation. It isn't always inherently wheelchair based, but right. The main difference that I'm glad you brought that up, but the main difference that I've always seen with Medicare and Medicaid is Medicare only covers stretcher transportation. And Medicaid can cover stretcher transportation, but as a separate defined benefit will also cover wheelchair and sometimes other forms of transportation that a patient may need to get to their appointments. And from a Medicare perspective, the important thing to understand is that that stretcher transportation has a medical necessity component that everything else does. And you hit the nail on the head, other means, meaning that it is not safe for the patient to go. And one of the key definers in the Medicare benefit is the patient can't sit, stand, or walk. They're bed confined. It's not safe for them to do it. So, when we're talking about ambulance transportation, there's two kinds, right? There's emergency and non-emergency. Right. And when we're talking about emergency, that that is where it is a 911 or equivalent dispatch, and that the crew took steps to respond immediately to that emergency. the patient is brought to the closest facility that is able to provide that help to that patient or stabilize that patient. It is not based on patient choice inherently, because it's an emergency and you should be going to the hospital that is going to be able to provide that care. And then the other half of the coin is non-emergency. And there's two kinds of non-emergency. And I think this is where people get a little confused. So there's regularly scheduled non-emergency, and then there's unscheduled non-emergency. So the regularly scheduled non-emergency is typically your patient who goes two or three times a week for things like a dialysis treatment, and they're gone and they're taken, they're transported by stretcher. And that requires a certificate of medical necessity or a physician's certification or however you want to call it, but it's essentially a piece of paper with a bunch of boxes that are checked in which the doctor is certifying that this patient has to go by stretcher for this particular reason and right. that there's that medical necessity. And those are your non-emergency scheduled, you know, hey, we're picking you up, Mrs. Smith, at 10 o'clock and we're taking you to your dialysis appointment and bringing you home. And then there's the unscheduled non-emergency. And this is, I think, where this is where the gray area is, particularly in the instances where people are being transported for convenience. And, you know, just from a background perspective, I was an EMT for about 30 years. I worked as an EMT, as an advanced EMT in New York State. I worked as an EMT in Pennsylvania, and I worked as an EMT in New Jersey, depending upon where I was living at the time. I got credits in college for it, started off with some first aid classes, and you know, wound up working for municipally. I worked in the city of Buffalo when I was when I was in college and graduate school. I worked for the municipal department that was there. I was a crew chief on the volunteer ambulance we had on campus. And then along the way, I've, you know, worked for a bunch and volunteered for a bunch when I was an OIG agent. You know, I was an EMT and did a lot of training and stuff. So I understand that landscape well. In our capacity, in my capacity here at Advise, we have a contract to do very niche fraud, waste, and abuse reviews on behalf of a third-party payer for a self-insured, where we look at that sometimes they're called PCRs, pre-hospital care reports, or ACRs, ambulance call reports, or, you know, we were talking about this before, or the run sheet, or it's essentially right. the medical documentation that the crew puts together. And right. so, you know, you get these patients where they go three times a week to dialysis, and the company, it's a private transport company, it's not a volunteer organization, it's not an actual 911 call, and the people know the company, they like the company, it's a private transport, you know, ABC Medical Transport, they right. know them, they like them. Person isn't feeling well, they want to go to the hospital, and so instead of calling 911, they call this private transport company and say, hey, this is Mrs. Smith, you take me three times a week for dialysis, I'm not feeling well, could you please bring me to this hospital? And that hospital could be, you know, 20, 30 miles away. And then right. the private ambulance company goes, picks up the person and brings them to that ER of their choosing. And that may be an emergency, but, you know, typically it's, you know, I would call that it's your unscheduled non-emergency transport.
Right.
And then you get the same, and we'll talk a little bit about these schemes with respect to SNFs and the like. But, you know, the part I want to drive home is that there's actually in the regulations some language that says if it is a non-emergency unscheduled transport, you don't have to hold up transport for getting the certificate of medical necessity, but the ambulance transport company needs to get that certificate of medical necessity within 48 hours of the transport. So right. they don't need to hold up because it could be 8 in the morning, the doctor that wants the patient to go to the emergency room for an evaluation from the skilled nursing facility may not be there, but you know, you have this 48-hour window, which is enough time for the doctor to be able to sign that CMN. You know, you'd see, for example, the skilled nursing facility's doctor wants the patient to go because they've got abnormal labs, you know, their creatinine level is off. And so they right. want it to be evaluated in the hospital. They can't evaluate them in the facility because the facility doesn't have the medical wherewithal to do that. So, you know, these non-emergency, non non-scheduled type, you know, type transports. But so let's bring this back. Let's talk about this case that you worked on that, or these cases that you worked on, and you know, tell us about what was the fact pattern there.
Yeah. So the cases that we were encountering in Texas were a little bit different than what you were kind of describing there. So I started working ambulance cases almost immediately when I started working healthcare fraud for the Medicare contractor in 2000. There was this kind of explosion of private ambulance companies that were coming into the Medicare program. And they were all essentially targeting the regularly scheduled non-emergent three times a week dialysis patients, right? And while some of the patients were reside in SNFs, a lot of them resided in their own private homes, right? So it was all these ambulance claims coming in from various providers that had the R to J, J to R modifier, right? So for the listeners out there that might not be familiar with ambulance modifiers, you know, they're slightly different than, you know, typical healthcare claim modifiers. It's a two-letter modifier. The first letter designates the origin of the transport. The second letter designates the destination of the transport. R is a residence. It's typically a private residence, because N would be a nursing home, a SNF. And then J is a freestanding dialysis facility. So it was all these companies that came in and tried to fill in this finite space, right? So how many patients, I mean, there's lots of patients, unfortunately, that suffer from kidney disease that have to go to dialysis three times a week, but not every single one of them is in a condition to where another form of transportation would be contraindicated. Right. So what we were seeing was these companies would go out and market to maybe dialysis facilities. Well, not necessarily to the dialysis facility itself, but were granted access to the facility and can market directly to patients. And, you know, we can come pick you up. We won't inconvenience. You won't have to inconvenience, you know, a family member or be out of pocket for bus fare. We will come pick you up. And at the time, a lot of off-duty firefighters were kind of being hired as the EMT companies. And that was kind of it had appeal to these patients, right? This off-duty firefighter, because in a lot of the municipalities in Texas, your firefighters are cross-designated as firefighters and paramedics. And so, you know, we have these firefighters that are paramedics, and, you know, they'll take good care of you. And that's, you know, that's the case. So we had this explosion of non-emergent ambulance claims from residences to dialysis facilities in the early 2000s that just started swamping us. And I just started working cases left and right. And as, you know, as I improved in my job, understood data better, that's when we started getting, having more success, right? Because within the ambulance construct, especially like I mentioned in Texas, we have a lot of dual eligible beneficiaries. I think that particular fact helped us with some data analytics that started to make these cases a lot stronger. Right.
Sure.
So the claim would come in. It would be a non-emergent, you know, it could be a BLS. It could be an ALS, right? Transport. You know, they're going to get, if there was providers out there that were saying, well, my truck is licensed as an ALS. My crew is licensed as an ALS.
Right.
We can bill it at ALS.
Right.
That's absolutely
not correct.
Right.
I mean, the fact that your truck is staffed with two paramedics,
right,
and ALS and BLS, the difference is BLS is basic life support, and that's a truck that's typically staffed with two EMTs. And really, the simplest way to, and ALS is advanced life support, which is typically staffed by at least one EMT, one paramedic. Every state's got a different definition of what a paramedic is. But the big definer is that, generally speaking, EMTs cannot do things like inserting IVs,
right,
and medication delivery and things like that, whereas paramedics and the like are able to do that. But I think that's the big thing, is the mere fact that the truck is staffed with someone who has a paramedic level training and certification does not inherently give the company the ability to submit a claim for advanced life support. It's not who staffs the truck, it's the level of care that's provided to the patient.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, some of the cases that we worked ended up just being sent back for recoupment on that exact fact, right? It was, you're billing everything as ALS when it should be BLS. For the longest time, a lot of the claims were coming in with I've mentioned this on another podcast. Then it was an ICD-9, now it's an ICD-10, but it was an ICD-9 code that indicated that the patient was bed confined, because there is a specific diagnosis code to indicate bed confinement. And that's what a lot of these providers were doing on their claims to send them in, I guess to somewhat avoid scrutiny. But right, then you start thinking about how many bed confined dialysis patients are there?
Right. How is it that company is getting the lion's share of them?
Well, not even that company, right? It's how are there so many bed confined dialysis patients in a geographic space, and there's 20 private ambulance companies fighting all for the same patients, right? So, and the reason to backtrack just a little bit, the reason why this particular patient type is so appealing is because even the non-emergent transports get paid a substantial amount. It's like our hearing aid case that we discussed and you brought up. The payment numbers on these providers would go through the roof into the, you know, $1-3 million. And it's because each transport was getting reimbursed at, you know, $1,500-$2,000 one way. And so you think of it as a two-way trip, and three times a week for a single patient, it can be lucrative. And
right. So sure, it's a lot of money. So it's easy to start to build those dollars, because it's a volume business. What's interesting is, from the data perspective, the very first thing that always comes to mind for me on these ambulance transports, that where you've got residents as your place of origin, is that would imply these people are in their home, bed confined. And so from a data perspective, the first question is, how are they getting to, what are their other visits like, right? Their other doctor visits, what are those looking like? And, you know, the typical thing to keep in mind is that if you're homebound and you're on, you know, dialysis three times a week, you're not able to leave your house, you should be seeing visits for things like home visits for medical care,
right,
and things like, because you can't get out, and the Medicaid program typically isn't paying for transports to doctor's offices as a Medicare benefit. So if you're seeing that your patients are going to dialysis three times a week by stretcher from their home,
right,
and then on the same day to service, they have an ophthalmology appointment, you know, it's not a lot of work. Then, you know, you go, first of all, you go interview the beneficiary, and they answer the door. So that's going to be, you know, that we call that a clue. I'll never forget. I tell this story a lot, but one of the guys that I mentored in New Jersey, when he first started, we have an ambulance case that I'm helping him work. He's a brand new agent, helping him, you know, breaking him in as his mentor's field training agent. And we go to this house to go interview someone. It's an ambulance, you know, non-emergency. And the house is on a hill, and it's on a pretty steep hill, and there's probably four flights of concrete steps, you know, maybe 10 steps a landing, 10 steps a landing. It's a little bit like, you know, like watching like the Addams Family, right? You're going up these stairs, and we get to the house, we pull up to the house, we get out of the car, And the very first thing that I say to him is, what's the first clue? Right? This is an ambulance transport case. There's no ramp. There's nothing. It's like, well, how the hell is this person getting up and down? There's no way an ambulance crew is carrying this person up and down all these. So we get to the top of the stairs, and outside the on the porch is a motorized wheelchair. outside, right? So the motorized, there's a whole other discussion we can have about motorized wheelchairs and fraud in Texas,
post-Katrina
world.
I'm going to incorporate that exact
thing. All right, so we're going to table that. But
you stole my thunder, but I was going to incorporate that.
So we could always talk about ambulance fraud in the post-Katrina world when the modifier was added for that. But we get to the house, and there's a motorized wheelchair at the front door. And so I look at the kid and I go, well, what does that mean? And he looks at me and I go, that's called a clue as well. We knock on the door and the door opens and a woman answers the door. She's one of the homeowners. You've just answered the door. So So sometimes it's as easy as doing an interview with the beneficiary. Sometimes the data just helps you just in itself. So, that becomes an important piece.
Yeah, and I think, you know, sticking with that theme, you know, the data analytics, we incorporated separate data sets. You know, some of it was claims, some of it was other information in the development of these cases as they moved along, right? And part of our limitation in our data is kind of the underlying reason as to why CMS transitioned the benefits integrity component, the fraud, waste, abuse component from the contractor itself to a PSC, to a ZPIC, to ultimately the UPIC, right? Because when I first started working these cases for, it was Trailblazer at the time, Trailblazer Health Enterprises was the MAC, and the benefits integrity unit was housed within the MAC. The only data we had access to was Part A, Part B claims. So you can use cross claims analysis on the patient to see, okay, on the Part A side, are they being seen by a home health agency? If not, that's kind of suspect. Are they seeing other providers regularly outside of, you know, the dialysis facility, right? Or the nephrologist that treats them at the dialysis facility. When we transition from the benefits integrity unit in the MAC to the PSC, the PSC component brought in a little bit of DME. And we had a DME investigator within the PSC. So what we could start doing was, okay, if this person is bed confined, let's bounce their claims off the DME and see, is there a bed that they've received to help them with their bed confinement?
Absolutely.
Is there any other DME that would contradict the bed confined aspect of the ICD-9 cone? So do they have a walker? Do they have a cane? Do they have a motorized scooter? Do they have a power wheelchair, right? And one of the things that kind of took off at the time when we transitioned to Tri-Centurion, which was the PSC at the time, was, as you noted, the power wheelchair scam exploded in Houston and then across Texas and then across the country, kind of around the same time that we were still dealing with all these ambulances. And in order to become more efficient and effective at investigating both, what we started doing, starting to see, okay, what patients are being regularly transported to and from dialysis and what patients are also receiving a power wheelchair? And let's kind of start focusing interview resources on those patients. Because the flip side of that being, you know, who's signing the certificate of medical necessity for the regularly scheduled ambulance transport? What are they saying? And who's signing the certificate of medical necessity for the power wheelchair? And is there some sort of commonality between those, right?
So the thing that's interesting about this is that what winds up happening is that as you start to become more proficient in your understanding of a fraud scheme, the more that you can become efficient at understanding how the data is going to mix and match. And this is where, and I have this conversation in the data analytics space pretty frequently with people, and I've presented on this, I talk about it all the time, is that the data is great, but you always need to have that human element. You need to be able to have a human element for things like false positives, false negatives. You really only want positive positives, right? You want the stuff that you've cross-matched it to things and said, hey, how is it that this person has a diagnosis that shows that they're bed confined or is going three times a week to dialysis because they can't safely sit, stand, or walk, but yet 3 months ago, they got a walker or they got a wheelchair or every other visit that they have with every other healthcare provider, the place of service is 11, office. How are they getting to the office? You know, so you start to narrow down. So you're not looking at every single patient because a broken clock is right twice a day, right? So some patients are going to actually need to go by, you know, by stretcher. And the object is, you know, we would have new agents who they, you know, they don't want to be in the office, right? They want to be in the field and they want to get that. And I get it, right? As I got older, I wanted to be in the field less because I felt like, you know, if there are other ways to skin the cat. And, you know, I would find these new agents would spend their day following an ambulance around all day because, and in some cases you have to do that because there's instances where, you know, some of the fraud schemes, you know, I think, you know, really what you're alluding to is the fraud scheme of that the ambulance transport company is bringing this patient three times a week because they're being listed as bed bound, but they're really not. And so Medicare is paying this extra benefit when it really should just be a much lower level of service, not on the secondary reimbursement on Medicaid for the ambulance transport, but it should be a $12, you know, wheelchair ride, or it should be a family transport ride. But then, you know, the other fraud, which is, I think, the more difficult one, which really does require people to be put eyes on, is the gang ones where they're loading up that ambulance like it's a school bus. And they got a patient in the front seat and there's three in the bench and there's, you know, somebody, whoever's the first on gets to sit on the stretcher, you know, something like that. And it's really like a, it's like a Las Vegas party van, you know, they're all in the back. And I that's a different fraud, right? That's one where you need to have eyes on and follow people and, you know, follow an ambulance and see, are there two people, three people in the truck? Right. And I would talk to new agents. And they would say, you know, I'm going out to do surveillance for today. I go, well, what are you doing? And they'd say, oh, I'm going to follow this ambulance around. Well, what's the allegation? Well, the allegation that these people aren't bedbound. So, okay. But, you know, is there a belief that they're putting two or three people in the truck? No, we're just not bedbound. So, okay. If they get brought out of the SNF, the skilled nursing facility, if they get brought out on a stretcher and they get wheeled from the ambulance into the dialysis center, and then they get wheeled from the dialysis center back into the stretcher, you know, into the ambulance, and then driven by ambulance back to the SNF, and then they go back. How do you know that they're not bedbound? You're sitting in your car because you're not going in and watching this happen. How do you know they're not bedbound? Like, what is spending your day following an ambulance of EMTs taxiing people on a stretcher from the point you see them to the point you don't see them to the point you see him to the point you don't see him? How is that moving your case along? You know, and then you have to educate them on looking at things like the data to become more efficient in how you're going to do your case.
Yeah, I mean, I was a big believer. You know, we've had discussions, we've been in comments set in the comment section on LinkedIn discussing fraud, waste, and abuse, and you know, the types of methods in which, you know, UPICs and others kind of target providers, and everybody, you know, kind of immediately gravitates towards that, you know, that outlier space, right? Where you know, my experience, where I've always had success, is not focusing on outliers. It's using more cross claims data analysis to kind of target, you know, what providers I'm looking at and what people I want to go talk to, for your exact point, which is to become more efficient. You know, I want to understand, I'm looking at this particular claim on this particular patient and it's saying this patient's bedbound. Okay. You know, a lot of these patients, the claims are indicating they're bedbound. Can I sit here at my desk? Can I sit here at my computer, push some buttons, hit some data, and see if I can develop information almost instantaneously that contradicts that bed confinement diagnosis code. And then I can start to decide, how do I want to allocate my time? Go interview the patient, maybe do some surveillance, things to that nature. So exactly, I mean, I'm in 100% agreement. I've had some success with surveillance. I've had some success not only identifying instances where, you know, multiple people jumped out of an ambulance. You know, you got the guy riding in the jump seat. You got the guy riding in the front seat.
It's like a clown car at the circus, right? Like the ambulance pulls up to the dialysis center, right, and 48 people come piling out.
But to your point, talking to your young agent about, you know, what if they wheel them out, right? There's one case I worked where I got incredibly lucky. Rolled up. I wanted to test the camera equipment. It was a digital camera. I wanted to see how clear the picture was. There's a person standing outside smoking a cigarette. So, okay, let me see. He's by the door. Let me get a picture from the perspective that we parked. How good is the picture going to come out? Can I see his face? Smokes a cigarette. He goes back in. About 10 minutes later, the ambulance company comes out, shows up, rolls a stretcher in. And when they come out, they're rolling this guy out on the stretcher who was the one staying outside smoking the cigarette. And just by sheer dumb luck, I had this great picture, right? Like, you know, wow.
Right.
I'm sure he's not bed confined. So, you know, using data was a big aspect of just about all my investigations and cross claims data. I was really, you know, the provider can only control what they control, which is their medical documentation, the claim that they submit to the program. They can't control all the other healthcare providers that interact with that patient.
Right. Absolutely.
And I can probably find some bit of information that's going to be useful from another provider. You know, so going back to what I was originally talking about, as we got access to more information, as this, you know, benefits integrity PSC concept began to evolve, you know, we got a bit better. We could start bouncing, you know, not only home health claims, but DME claims to contradict that. You know, one of the, to your point about the apartment complex, Dallas County, and I can't remember if they still do it. At the time that I was working cases, they would, you could look at their county appraisal district to look at the value of the home and who owns it, which is a very useful tool if anybody's out there. You want to know how much a home is or who actually owns it, go to your county appraisal district. But Dallas would actually have a photo of the house embedded in the link for the value and stuff like that.
Yeah, almost like a Google Earth.
Almost like a Google Earth, which I guess now you just use Google Earth. But I would research the house and look to see if the house in that picture, they had a ramp. Up the stairs. Do they have a front porch that has high stairs? Does it have a ramp? If not, okay, I might want to go talk to that person. Because, you know, these EMTs are good at what they do, but if they don't have to carry somebody down the stairs on a stretcher, they might not want to do that.
So when I worked my very first EMS job in Buffalo in the very late 80s, one of the, you know, the companies I worked for, the sort of the offhand joke was the rule of threes. 3 a.m., three flights of stairs, 300 pounds. You could probably walk into the ambulance. You know, in the middle of winter, it was, you know, if there was a foot of snow, if you were 3 flights of stairs, 300 pounds, right. You know, 3 a.m., man, that's a long night. And I worked overnights, 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. on the weekends.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of the times, like, how about you just come walk this way? But yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, when you're talking about these non-emergency transports in which it's twice or three times a week, the issue really is, you know, is that cost being shifted to Medicare when it really should either A, be a Medicaid expense, and then right. B, in instances when it's a Medicaid expense, it's obviously at a much lower rate than it would be if it was ambulance or even if it was, you know, via wheelchair van. So, you know, just in the interest of time, because we're getting close on time, you know, there's a couple of thoughts that I have that I wanted to, I've always believed, so, you know, let's take away the emergency piece. I can tell you in a lot of the reviews that we do here at Advise, with these private companies are doing transports, residents or SNF, particularly the ones that are SNF, skilled nursing facility to hospital, and they're really just not emergency. They're non-scheduled, non-emergency, and, you know, we'll see that there's instruction coming from someone in management on how to code or how to document the call sheets. One of the cases I worked in New Jersey, there was actually a policy in the manual that said for non-scheduled transports from a nursing home to the emergency room, you will write the following: BLS responded immediately. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I mean, that's just, you're just basically instructing your staff to provide false statements. And most of the time as an EMT, you don't know. I would have never known what the issue was with that. But, you know, some of the giveaways are the call gets received at 10 o'clock in the morning. It gets dispatched at 10:15 and the crew responds at 10:20. I mean, that's just not a respondent immediately. And they've got a 40-minute drive to the SNF. And then there's a 30-minute drive to the hospital. I mean, you can't even make stuff like that up as being an emergency, in any way, shape, or form. But the one thing that I've always believed to be potentially out there for the fraudulent provider of services and the fraudulent administrative or owners of the SNF was, I've always believed that there was a symbiotic relationship, meaning that for those that are covered by Medicare, the first 100 days of your SNF time is covered under the Medicare Part A benefit. Yeah. And that's an inclusive dollar amount in which any care that you need as a patient is supposed to be covered by the SNF. So if you go to a skilled nursing facility during that 100-day period and you need to go to dialysis 3 times a week, the SNF is supposed to pay for that. And if you're in a wheelchair, the SNF pays for that, right? So whatever that cost is. If during that period of time you are put onto a stretcher, Medicare Part B pays for that. And so I have always believed that what happens is that there are instances, because a lot of times the SNF will have a contract with a particular transport company where when it's a cost that's incurred by the SNF directly.
Right.
That there's typically some very aggressive and favorable pricing, right? So the ambulance company, which runs a wheelchair van, says, hey, if you wanna, if Eric Rubenstein wants to go visit his family on a Sunday and has to go by wheelchair, Medicaid's not paying for that.
Right.
So, you know, we're gonna give you a favorable rate. We're only gonna charge you or the patient $20 for that. Or if it's a transport that the SNF would have to pay, we're going to give you this very, very discounted rate for that. But in return, you're going to give us all of your stretcher work and all this other stuff. So I've always believed that there's this push-pull that exists because there's contractual relationship on getting, in some cases, these favorable. I can never prove this, right? And this is just me looking back over my time. This is just me having, this keener eye to thinking about where the fraud schemes could be.
Right.
But certainly when you see a lot of people going from a nursing home to dialysis and you then go and you look at the SNF records and you see that the patient is going to physical therapy 3 times a week and they're ambulating in a wheelchair or they're ambulating in a walker. I mean, I've had cases where I did that. I requested the social service notes.
Yeah.
You know, I subpoenaed the social service notes. If the family is coming to take them out for lunch twice a week,
right?
How are they getting to the Applebee's?
Yeah.
Right? How are they getting to wherever? They're going for Sunday dinner at the family house and the family's picking them up and taking them. They're not bed confined. If they're going to physical therapy 3 times a week and there's, you know, information that shows that they're ambulating, you know, a lot of times I think the problem is that the medical directors or the doctors that are signing off on the CMNs are just, you know, whatever. I don't, you know, what do they know? Yeah. They don't, you know, it's not really their care. The crews don't know any better because the crews just know I got to be here at this time to take you. You know, the ambulance drivers are showing up.
Right.
And so I've always believed that that was a piece that was a problem. I know in my, in a lot of the audits that we do now, we'll see these inter-facility transports, hospital to hospital, where you'll see the patient is being transported from hospital A to hospital B because the family wants them transported. And I've had instances where I've looked where it's being billed as an emergency because it's going from one emergency room to the other. That's just the most ridiculous.
Well, and that kind of brings up a, another type of fraud scheme that was less prevalent than the ones that I was dealing with, but it's being falsifying your modifier to indicate more of a covered service as opposed to the regular scheduled, you know, it might be hospital to dialysis facility, right? Instead of residence dialysis facility. But, you know, and going back to your discussion on SNFs and the private ambulance company running a wheelchair in or an ambulance, you know, two kind of points. When I moved to Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, I got access to Medicaid data. The UPICs now have that, but I didn't have Medicaid data until I got to Mufuku. So what we could start doing is look to see what patients were being transported under the medical transport program, the solely Medicaid program. And you would see that a number of patients would ping pong between ambulance and MTP transport, depending on, you know, the day of the week. So that was useful. We also, when I got to Mufuku, had access to driver's license info and motor vehicle registration. And we would every once in a while find that a patient that's bed confined had a very active DL and a vehicle registered in their own name. So,
my favorite would be if you had a scenario where you got a patient who on, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday is going for dialysis by stretcher, and they had to get them and they wound up getting some sort of moving violation on a Tuesday.
Well, I mean, there was definitely times that running their DL or running DLs. And getting traffic ticket information was, you know, extremely helpful in development of a fraud case. You know, how could a provider have billed for all these services at this location in this city when he got a ticket, you know, 500 miles away, right? In another part of Texas. So, it seems, you know, when I was working cases, you know, I had the great benefit of working a case as a PSC investigator and then having it be one of my first cases assigned to me as a Mufuku investigator and getting, you know, that very first criminal conviction with OIG in the Eastern District of Texas. And that was really kind of great, not vindication or validation, but, you know, to have worked something where I referred it to OIG. And then got to be responsible for bringing the case forward with my, you know, my partner at OIG and getting that was a big deal. So you don't get into law enforcement for the attaboys, right? That we used to call them that with DPD. You got to save up all the attaboys because as soon as you get one oh shoot. It takes a lot of attaboys to make up for an oh shoot.
Yeah, I put it at 100 to 1. I would say 100 attaboys is immediately negated by one aw shucks.
Yeah.
Immediately 100 to 1. So you got to keep those. You got to keep those in your pocket.
But what's so interesting about our conversation that we're having today is how, you know, what was going on in Texas in the early 2000s with the residents to dialysis transports that became very prevalent. But, you know, each part of the country started to experience a variation of that fraud scheme. And, you know, to the point where, you know, you in the New York, New Jersey area were seeing a variation involving SNFs more often. But it's all the same. You're transporting people that aren't covered under that particular benefit.
So this is where, you know, this is where we loop this back as a retro fraud, is that oftentimes I say all the time that the circus doesn't change, just the clowns are different. You know, and the retro fraud podcast I did a couple of weeks ago with one of my former coworkers, Wade McFowl, where he talked about essentially identity theft and physical checks has morphed itself into identity theft and electronic funds transfers. And so same sort of scheme, they just sort of morphed themselves. You know, obviously, and just as a wrap up, you know, as a result of a lot of the fraud that was going on in the ambulance transport industry nationwide, CMS did something that they really hadn't done before, which was they did two things. One is that they instituted as a pilot pre-authorizations for non-emergency routine transports. It started off in a couple of states, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and I think North Carolina were the three initial, maybe Texas, but it's since expanded. It's in something like 6 or 8 locations now. One of the studies that I had read was that as a result of pre-authorization, the overall expenditures on ambulance transports dropped substantially because these authorizations were being denied for one reason or another. And I don't remember the rationale behind why, but obviously the pre-authorization piece worked. And as a result of it working as a fraud, waste, abuse tool, it was since expanded to other states. So, you know, you don't really see a ton. At least I haven't seen a lot of press releases on a lot of ambulance fraud cases as of late. I think that there's other priorities. And so maybe these cases are as prevalent. They're just being handled in different ways. I could tell you that for a period of time in District of New Jersey, there was kind of a unwritten declination that was out there criminally for ambulance transport cases. They would be dealt with more civilly or administratively. And that wasn't, and I caveat it by saying, like, if it was fraud, it was fraud. Like, it wasn't like, oh, I have an ambulance case, U.S. Attorney's Office is going to decline it. But there had to be really like a plus factor. There had to be something really like egregious, like the service wasn't rendered at all or something to make it attractive. Otherwise, it was a better civil case or a CMP administrative case, to be out there. But yeah, these are great cases. And I think you're right, Matt. What happens in one area, typically it percolates around the country to other areas. And whether that percolation be the same fraud or it be some iteration of the same fraud, with maybe a slightly different nuance because of, that makes it more nuanced than it should be.
Well, you gotta, fraudsters have to accommodate for, enforcement action. So, if everybody's, venturing down the same path. Right.
Regional norms and mores.
You should copyright that. That's good.
Exactly. I like that. I have a lot of isms, Rube-isms that I'm gonna as time goes on. Well, listen, Matt. Thanks very much as always. I mean, we're always talking. We're always finding new things to chat about, whether it's current stuff, whether it's other stuff. You know, if you're not following Matt on LinkedIn, you got to find him on LinkedIn. If you're not following me, you got to find me on LinkedIn. We have a lot of these conversations. Matt and I met through LinkedIn. I'm calling it the professional Tinder. but, we've got a little network of people. You and I are talking constantly about these things, and our network are talking constantly about these things. And, as I always say, and I know you agree, it's always right is right and wrong is wrong. If you've done something that you believe is right and there's a way to mitigate what someone believes is wrong, then we have to do that. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And, part of your job as a defense attorney is sometimes it is the virtual colonoscopy, right? It's explaining, cleaning out your defendant's rationale for why this is a problem, but also mitigating it. Is it as bad as it should be? The example I always give is loss amount calculations. We could talk for hours about loss amount calculations and sometimes that aggressive approach that's taken on billed versus paid and intended losses and all that. Right is right, wrong is wrong. And if you've done something wrong and you got to pay the piper for doing something wrong, is it something that's wrong but can be mitigated? Is it something that's really like, I can't mitigate this. We got to sort of figure out how to resolve this. But, it doesn't mean that when you switch your hats from doing things on the government and the prosecution side to doing things that are on either the defense or, I throw in fraud, waste, abuse, compliance, because I truly believe that if providers had done some things in the compliance world the right way, they would have never met me on their civil cases. The fraud stuff, the compliance piece doesn't matter. And I truly think you probably have that with a lot of your clients as well. If they just had some good compliance measures in place, some of the problems that they have would have been mitigated earlier on. But it's really like, how do we fix this now?
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. If you're committed to doing fraud, then people like myself Well, I mean, as an attorney, I could try my best, you know, but the good people like you and those that advise that try to be proactive. I have a very proactive component to my practice. That's going to be those people that want to understand how to do it correctly, knowing that within such a heavily regulated industry, mistakes can happen. And you just got to be prepared on how to handle those. Right.
So as always, great having you on. I look forward to always having our talks. I look forward to us always getting together and chatting about stuff. And yeah, we're going to figure out our next time to chat, and you know, we're going to keep it going. So as always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for jumping on the YouTube channel. For those of you that are watching this, you can subscribe. There's a whole bunch of content on the YouTube channel. You can also go to adviseyou.com. We've got a bunch of free content up there. There's some paid content. We really do think that our paid content is not only good content, but it's super reasonably priced, because it's really about educating people and just really covering the expenses of the time it takes us to do it. So as always, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for being part of the solution to fraud, waste, abuse, compliance stuff. Thanks for tuning in to the Rush for Fraud, and we'll see you on the next recording.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you, everybody.